Hello and welcome, listeners, to The Europeans. Thank you for downloading our latest episode. This week we're going to be talking about megaliths. Can I get an appropriate sound effect for that robust sounding word, Katie?
I have literally no idea what that's supposed to sound like. A megalith is a big rock. Should I make a big rock sound?
Yeah, like a big rock falling to the ground.
Okay, here you go.
Not that we're suggesting that megaliths arrived on this earth by flying from the sky, but we're going to find out exactly why or how megaliths started emerging around in Europe during the Neolithic era. And I felt like this interview is going to be a nice antidote to all the madness that's been going on this week regarding the B word in the British Parliament. In fact, my dad said to me this week, surely you've got to talk about Brexit this week. And I said, no, This is the week more than ever that we should be talking about the other things that are happening in Europe, because people are getting more than enough of their Brexit fill. Maybe we're about to say the same thing, but it turns out that quite a lot of my colleagues and the people I meet in the Netherlands really have no idea what's going on. I was getting high-fived by various colleagues during a show when they checked their phone in the interval and seen that there was a breaking news alert saying that no deal had been ruled out. And people were like, it means Brexit's off.
No.
And I was like, no, that's not what it means.
I mean, at least that's better than, I saw a survey in Italy saying that a third of Italians think that Brexit has already happened.
Oh, wow.
And they're like, oh, what? You guys are still here. So at least your colleagues are kind of keeping more or less up to date.
Yeah, well, do you remember about a year and a half ago, I got rejected from the EU queue by a mean Irish immigration lady because she was like, nope, you're not EU.
Still here for a while, love.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, no, it's not very current that we're going to be talking about ancient rocks. Basically, things like Stonehenge, those amazing stone monuments that you can see all over Europe. Bettina Schultz-Paulsen is going to be here to chat about her research all around these amazing structures and how on earth the knowledge of how to build these things spread across Europe.
It may sound quite niche, but actually she's been like making international headlines, including like the New York Times, because her research is really groundbreaking. So we're actually quite excited to have her on the podcast.
I hear that you have been avoiding me again, Dominic.
No. What?
Well, just that I got to London yesterday from Paris. It's a really bad time to be commuting between London and Paris at the moment, by the way, because of all the Eurostar strikes. But yeah, I got here to find that you had just left. What's the deal with that?
Yeah, I actually, listeners, this is quite crazy. I bumped into Katie's boyfriend. I was busted being in London for just over 24 hours. And it was very, very nice to bump into him and some of our other friends, one of whom had their birthday. Eleanor, happy birthday. But it's literally my worst nightmare. I feel guilt. Whenever I come back to London for a brief time, I usually don't tell anyone because I was there this time just to see my baby nephew. Aww. And then I bumped into loads of my friends, including your boyfriend. And I was like, oh shit, I'm sorry.
Honestly, you've got to stop avoiding me like this. It's becoming very obvious. I'm going to hunt you down. I'm coming to Amsterdam at the end of the month. So listeners, he can't stop me.
I'll have enough of you then.
Before we get properly into this week's show, I guess like a lot of people, I spent quite a lot of this week being really angry and really sad about what's happened in New Zealand. And our hearts really go out to everyone affected by this sickening crime that has been committed in Christchurch. I had to read the bullshit manifesto that the attacker wrote. I read it at work, unfortunately, because it seems the attacker was like heavily inspired by this racist French writer. So people are talking about it a lot here. And among the many things that have been upsetting about this, it was this guy had visited Europe, he visited France, the country that I call home most of the time, and he was really appalled by how non-white it has become. And among the vile reasons he gave for the attack, he said that he wanted to divide the European people from the invaders occupying European soil. It goes without saying that this is a vision of Europe that is really sick and wrong and like really historically misguided. This is not a continent of people who have a better right to live than others just because of the colour of their skin. So, I don't know. Personally, I think the best thing we can do to honour the people that were murdered this week is give your friends a hug if they come from a different culture than you. Go out and make new ones as well.
That sounds like a very good thing to do. I was in New Zealand over New Year, so fell in love with the country, and I was really, really saddened, like everyone else, to see this news.
So, on with the show. Have you got anything for Commemoration Corner this week?
Yes. I'd like to thank Daniel Farrell in our Patreon group for pointing out that the 18th of March marks the 5-year anniversary of the annexation of Crimea. Putin will be celebrating by visiting Crimea just as they are launching two controversial power plants at full capacity. And they're controversial because they are made out of parts that are not meant to be delivered from EU countries to the Ukraine. And they think somehow they've got there a bit illegally through Russia, maybe.
Oh.
But the UN are marking the event by discussing the anniversary in a Security Council meeting. And it should be pointed out that a majority of international governments still believe that Crimea is part of the Ukraine and view the referendum, which is now 5 years old, as illegal. Right now, I'm just glad we didn't call this segment Anniversary Annex, as had been suggested by one of our lovely listeners, because it would have been very inappropriate this week.
Annexation Annex.
Annexation Annex.
It's got a kind of ring to it. It's funny. I remember as a journalist at a time, there was a conversation over whether we should describe what Russia had done as annexing a territory, because it was felt among some people that like the word annexation had this like really strong Nazi connotations, which is interesting because it kind of hits home like how stable our borders have been in Europe since World War II. Like we just haven't really had to talk about territory changing hands that much until 5 years ago.
Yeah. But nothing's changing at the moment, and I can't see how things are going to change again soon. So we'll probably be marking the 10-year anniversary on this podcast on 18th of March, 2024. Can't do maths. It has been a good week for Italian school children, I would argue anyway, after a law came into effect that forbids children under six from attending kindergarten or nursery unless they can prove, or their parents can prove, that they've been vaccinated. Obviously, it's not a good week for those kids who are being banned from their kindergarten, although I think some of those kids might see it as a good thing. On top of this, parents whose children are aged between 6 and 16 and are not vaccinated will receive a fine of up to €500 because they couldn't actually ban children from 6 to 16 from not going to school. So instead, they'd make the parents pay lots of money. The law is already thought to have pushed the vaccination levels closer to the World Health Organization's recommended level of 95% compared to the alarmingly low sub 80% level where it had been sitting in Italy before the bill went through Parliament.
Seriously?
Yeah, it's perhaps a little surprising that this bill came into force whilst Italy is being run by two populist parties that might otherwise be expected to line up with the populist tendency to be sceptical of vaccines. But the bill was in fact passed by the previous centre-left government and was initially criticised by the now governing Five Star Movement. But the founder of the party, Beppe Grillo, then decided not to oppose the bill, which is perhaps a small miracle. While researching the story, I found that there was a study that came out in February this year showing a strong correlation between countries where anti-establishment parties are doing very well and countries where there's a big mistrust of vaccines. So countries such as Italy, Greece and Austria all have high numbers of anti-vaxxers. And it seems to tie in, I guess, quite obviously with the anti-establishment suspicion of experts and elites. And yeah, the anti-vaccine movement has been growing at an alarming rate in recent years, but it has been around for a while. And a lot of the suspicion around vaccines stem from a now totally discredited paper from the 90s by Andrew Wakefield, which claimed there was a connection between autism and the measles, mumps and rubella vaccine. Andrew Wakefield was struck off the register following that paper, and his paper and theory were completely debunked. He did, after all, only have a sample of 12 children from which he made this bold declaration. Jesus, the amount of damage he did by having a crappy scientific paper.
We've talked about him before on the podcast. I was just trying to remember why.
Yeah, we have. I can't remember either.
If anyone can remind us why we've talked about this before, we've been doing this for too long, let us know.
But yeah, anti-vaxxers seem to be using social media very well, and many of them are making money from spreading misinformation. So it's a huge international problem, and it is particularly worrying for children with medical conditions that mean they are not actually able to take the vaccines themselves due to low immunity. The system needs at least 95% of children to be taking the vaccine in order to create a kind of herd immunity, which makes the chance of the disease spreading incredibly low and therefore protects these children who are unable to take the vaccine. But that was meant to be Good Week.
I was going
to
say.
Yeah, and it is Good Week because despite the fact that Italy is run by a coalition of anti-establishment parties, the enforced vaccination bill has still come into force. So Good Week, Italy.
That is a really good week.
Who's it been a bad week for?
Well, I had a couple of options this week. I was tempted to do Finland because of the government resigning. But I figured that we don't really talk about like EU level politics that much. And actually nobody does, which is probably why we have such a like problem with like the health of our democracy in Europe and people just not paying attention. You know how last week I was confidently proclaiming that centrism was like alive and well in Europe?
Oh yeah, I remember that.
This week, bad week goes to European centrists. Specifically, the main block of centrist parties from different countries that group themselves together at the EU level into one big party called ALDE. And it was at this point in my research that I realised how little we talk about European level politics, because I've never actually said that name out loud before.
But isn't it an acronym for something?
Yeah, it's the Alliance of Liberals and Democrats for Europe. I've been calling it ALDE in my head, like the German supermarket. But I looked at some YouTube videos to check the pronunciation, and most people say ALDE. So there you go, ALDE. Anyway, ALDE, the party, has had a bad week. And this touches on everyone's favourite theme in politics, lobbying and dirty money from big business trying to influence the people that make our laws. This is about a row that has broken up over the past week after an investigation by two French media outlets, Le Monde and France 2 Television. They basically found out that ALDE had taken €425,000 over the past 5 years from some companies that you may have heard of, which include Google and Microsoft. Now, the money was used to pay for party conferences, which is perfectly legal at the EU level, but that is illegal in a bunch of EU countries themselves. So it's generated unwelcome headlines for ALDE, and it comes at a particularly crucial time because they really want to team up with Emmanuel Macron's party, La République En Marche, for the European elections, which are coming up in May. Macron's party came out and said, this is unacceptable that Europe centrists are funding themselves with this corporate cash. And under pressure, ALDE came forward and said, we're very sorry, we won't take any corporate donations like this in the future. This is a really nerdy story, but I think it's really important. It's put a spotlight on the role of big corporations in Brussels and lobbying, which is this massive industry that doesn't get nearly as much attention as it should. In ALDE's case, they were like, well, it's only 4% of our budget, and this wasn't really lobbying. It's just these companies gave us some money so that they could put up stands at our conferences. But along with companies like Google and Microsoft, the party have in the past also taken money from Monsanto, ooh, which is this chemical company at the centre of major controversy over a weed killer that they make called Roundup, which contains an ingredient which the World Health Organization thinks probably causes cancer. Monsanto have been lobbying like crazy in the EU not to get this ingredient, glyphosate, banned. And back in 2017, the EU decided not to ban it for at least another 5 years. Coincidence? Maybe. But yeah, lobbying is this huge thing in Europe and we don't pay it nearly enough attention.
Monsanto was the organisation that Hillary Clinton was alleged to have ties to, and that really caused her a lot of problems. Monsanto just needs to go away.
Is that the new official policy of this podcast? Go away, Monsanto.
Yeah, it is. But thank you for explaining that story for me, because it's one of those slightly weedy stories that I kind of ignored this week.
I'm here for you. Right, rocks. Let's talk about rocks, Dominic. We haven't talked about rocks since we interviewed Andy Buchanan about photographing the European Stone Stacking Contest. Great episode, by the way. Here's my habitual plug for our previous work. Go back and listen to it. It's from May the 1st last year. And actually, this interview is also about stone stacking on a different kind of scale. We're talking about things like Stonehenge, these ancient constructions that when you look at them today, you just think, how the hell did people thousands and thousands of years ago build these things before we had like trucks and diggers and stuff? These are the objects that have fascinated our guest this week for her entire career as an archaeologist, and it's work that has taken her all over Europe. Bettina Schultz-Pelsen is a researcher at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden, and for the last decade or so, she has been trying to work out how the know-how to build these things ended up spreading across Europe. It's all very mysterious, so we gave her a ring in Gothenburg to talk about it. These big piles of rocks, or megaliths to use the actual term, as British people, Dominic and I are British, to us the most familiar one is Stonehenge, but they can really be found across lots of Europe, can't they?
They're not only found all across Europe, you can find them all around the world, but we don't know how connected they are. I think most are independent appearances. But in Europe, most people know Stonehenge. This is right. But there is so much more. There's so many amazing structures all around Europe, and it's really worth to visit them.
And so the starting point of your research, if I understand it correctly, was that you were trying to work out how these megalithic structures across Europe, hundreds of miles apart from each other, that seem to have similar characteristics and seem to be part of a similar tradition. Is that right?
Yes, because obviously they have the same architecture. They're either isolated or they're arranged in circles or in lines. They're also concentrated in the coastal regions. So this was one very interesting point, and also that the most of them orientated to the rising sun, also to the east or southeast.
Mm-hmm. And does that tell us something about why our ancestors thousands of years ago were building these things?
I don't know if it can say something about why, but maybe something about their ideology, about their religion.
And so you're calling the megalithic graves, but are there actual remains of bodies under all of them? Is that a connecting characteristic as well?
There are graves, the dolmens, passage graves and gallery graves, but the standing stones and stone circles are mostly not graves, even if we know that Stonehenge has a really one of the largest graveyards behind erected stones or cremated bones. But this is just an exception. This is not the normal case that stone circles were also serving as graveyards.
I know that for at least 100 years, archaeologists have been fascinated by this question of how early Europeans managed to build these things. Just to be clear, like, do archaeologists agree these days on how something like Stonehenge, this really impressive piece of engineering, like how our ancestors managed to build it? Or is that still disputed?
No, there is so many opinions as researchers who are working with it, I would say. To be honest, there is it's all hypothetical. We don't know really how these structures were built. We got parallels, ethnological parallels. There is recent societies in Indonesia, for example. They're still erecting megaliths. We know how they were doing. There is different hypotheses, but we cannot be sure in the end. So we don't know really yet, because if you see structures like in the early megalithic phases, like, for example, so my favorite example is the Grand Menhir. It is the largest standing stone. We know it was 21 meter long and it was weighing 330 tons. Can you imagine this?
Wow.
They were transporting it 12 kilometers from the Van region in a time around 4,700 or a little bit later before Christ. How were they doing it? 330 tons. This is for me not to imagine. And you need a lot of manpower for sure and a good organization, but really the technique in the end, we don't know. There's still a lot of research to do and all kind of simulations we can try.
So your research this time has been to do with dating thousands of these or samples of these stones. Is that right? What technology were you using to do that?
I was not dating myself. I was working with all available data.
Okay.
And for a future project, I want to produce my own data because I see now where the gaps are and where we can improve. A radiocarbon technique is working on organic material. As we can date today, we can date bones or charcoals, all kind of organic materials. And then you get a so-called probability for a time within 100 and 300 years. And there is a possibility over the Bayesian statistics to narrow the time interval. So we come to much more exact conclusions when an event happened. So when this grave was built or when there were burials or when an individual died. And I was using this, but was also taking into consideration the architecture, the burial rites, or then also the material we find in these graves, because we also have a rough idea about the temporality of materials of ceramic or there's all kind of material in these graves also.
What kind of things can be found in these graves?
Oh, many wonderful things. In Brittany, in these early phases, you find these wonderful jadeite eggs. As jadeite is a green stone, which is found in Europe, in the Piemont, also in northern Italy. You find Calais pearls, and this is really shiny green beads. You find even some gold, and you find eggs in all kind of stone materials. In late phases, you find arrowheads, all kind of material.
Have you come up with an idea of how you think these megaliths traveled and where they originated, where in Europe it started?
I think they started in Northwest France. We have quite strong evidence since we have the earliest onset of data. Plus, it's the only region where we have pre-megalithic monumental graves, and we can follow the transition from these graves to the megaliths. Also in these monumental graves, you have in the beginning drywall chambers, or the chambers were built out of organic material, for example. And then you see in structures like, for example, in Toumiac, in the Morbihan region, like the half of the grave is built with large stones. And then in the end, you got really the stone chambers in the graves.
And in terms of how the technology itself spread, the knowledge of how to make these things, do we know if it was because our little tribes were communicating and passing the knowledge between them? Or was it more that early Europeans were migrating and taking the technology with them? Or do we just really not know? Is it impossible to know?
I think we know quite much today, and it's all pointing more and more into one direction, that there was intercultural exchange over long distances. We have indications from maritime voyages, journeys, and we have indications for long-distance trade also. This is really interesting, I think.
Wow, so the European project perhaps is going on much longer than people think.
And what is also very interesting, I see this also confirmed over my last project. I was analyzing engravings and paintings in these graves, and you see how they're repeating all over Europe along the Atlantic facet. So these societies, they were exchanging also their symbols.
Are there differences in the design? Like, is there like a kind of classic Scandinavian design megalith as opposed to ones that are more commonly found in like Germany or France?
They're nearly all the same. It's very uniform, but there are, of course, regional differences. So we have in Scandinavia, we got a double chambers, double passage graves, for example. But the idea and the concept is the same all over Europe.
And are the materials that they're using to make these megaliths usually materials that are local to the area where they're being made?
Both. They can be local, but there's also a couple of cases where we know they have been transporting the stones over long distances. Stonehenge, we know the blue stones today, over 240 kilometers.
Wow.
You have had to travel a lot around Europe, Bettina, for about a decade looking at these megaliths for your research. And I read that you took your family with you a lot of the time. What was it like bringing them with you?
Oh, it was fun. Yeah, it was nice. Especially for my son. He has been growing up in megaliths, you can say. A British archaeologist, Richard Bradley, said once, my son saw more megaliths than the most archaeologists. Mm-hmm. He was very useful because sometimes the graves are really narrow, so I could send him in and he had to take the photos. He's growing, he's 192, so this is not working anymore. But it was actually very nice because I was partly many, many weeks on research trips and traveling, so it was really luxurious to take my family with. They were also helping a lot. There were location scouts, there were chauffeur, all kind of photo assistants. So we were a really good team in the end.
Has your son got a credit on the paper?
My son, when he took the photo, yes, it's his name under, also in my work. Yes, of course, I have to credit him.
Nice. I saw that there was a megalith in Scotland that was recently exposed as not to be a megalith. It was, in fact, put there by a farmer in the 1990s. Are you often having to be on the lookout for fakery like this, or is that a really unique example?
No, there are some, especially in regions where people are really crazy about megaliths. I know it's a big problem also in Brittany now, because people want to have standing stone in their garden, and sometimes they erect it themselves. And for us, it's sometimes hard to see, is it real standing stone, or was this now just erected by somebody who liked to have one in his garden? There is also cases, you know, where people are reusing megaliths, especially in Brittany. If you go sometimes to the graveyards, you find megalithic tombs built into a new grave, or they were doing with a standing stone, a gravestone. So also this is also there incorporated everywhere.
Wow. It must have been quite extraordinary for you over the last few weeks, having been working on this for a decade, I think, and now suddenly your research is getting huge international attention. Were you surprised to see how much interest there was, like being featured in the New York Times and asked to be on television?
Oh, yes, indeed. I was not prepared for that. And there was no handbook and nobody I could ask. But it's really nice, you know, if you're so long time on a topic and really try to do research, sometimes you're doubting, nobody is interested. I had people against me also, you know, within the scientific community who did not want to be convinced over my idea. And to see in the end that it's recognized from really from the scientific audience and that it's now starting to be, also that people are saying it's really right what she's saying. And also to hear this from colleagues who were before not of my opinion, but now when everybody else is saying they changed their mind. If people are interested in your research, this is really one of the nicest things you can have as a researcher. And yes, great.
So this week we heard the sad news that an incredibly valuable painting of the crucifixion by the 17th century Belgian artist Peter Bruegel the Younger was stolen from a church in Italy.
Oh.
Or was it?
I haven't heard about this.
It actually wasn't, so don't get too sad. The thieves smashed the glass case with a hammer and bunged the painting into their Peugeot. But little did they know, the Italian police had been tipped off about the impending crime and had replaced the original painting with a copy and installed surveillance. How cool is that?
That is super cool.
The mayor of the town, he was in on the sting operation and he actually initially expressed his sadness that a work of inestimable value had been taken from the community when speaking to the press. But this was all part of the ruse and he knew all along. And a few hours later, he admitted to the press that he had said that in order not to give the game away to the thieves too quickly while they were on the run. Actually, he thanked local residents because a few of the most beady-eyed locals had actually noticed that it wasn't the original. They'd been looking at it and being like, hey, something's changed here. But they kept quiet about it in the name of catching these thieves. It all sounds very exciting and satisfying, and I can't wait to watch the Hollywood remake of this saga, which will inevitably coming. Or maybe we should make a serialized podcast about it.
Love that idea. Who'd play the mayor?
Probably Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah, you want someone with gravitas.
Yeah.
Big role like that.
You really do. Someone who has to come out in front of the press and say something and then a few hours later admit that he was lying.
I smell an Oscar. Wait, can you get Oscars for podcasts?
No.
Not yet. Have they actually caught the thieves then?
Yeah, I can't actually find out if they've caught the thieves yet. I imagine that probably means they haven't. But if they haven't, then that's really not a very good happy ending, is it?
Well, I'm still quite happy because they didn't manage to steal the actual masterpiece.
That's true.
Thanks to this nifty little ploy here by the local authorities.
Oh, the thieves must be so annoyed.
All that thieving for nothing.
Anyway, we've got to go. I've got to go and do a show. But before we do, there are a few Patreon supporters I'd like to thank this week. Joe Bauer, Daniel Farrell, and Arthur Clarsons.
We thanked Arthur Clarsons last week, but he can still have an extra thanks. Double thank you, Arthur.
Arthur, double thank you. You could also be one of these people getting your name read out on our podcast if you go to patreon.com/Europeans podcast and donate as little as $1 a month.
Yes, we really appreciate it and it does help us keep this little show running. One thing that I think I might actually spend some of our Patreon money on is a second microphone because we were supposed to actually record this a couple of days ago and I just started setting up my studio, in inverted commas, and then had to call Dominic and say, haven't got a microphone. I've left it in London.
Oh, and that reminds me. I literally had a nightmare last night. I mean, a few hours ago. I woke up quite recently, as you may be able to hear my voice, and it is because I've got a cold. But yeah, I had a nightmare that I was at an interview for the podcast with a really interesting architecture collective, and I didn't have a second microphone.
Oh, God.
It was horrible. It's one of those ones that went on for hours as well with me trying to open the voice recorder app on my mobile phone and I couldn't open it.
I think I'm kind of almost flattered that the podcast has become such a huge part of your life that it's taking over your dreams. But I'm sorry that that was so stressful.
Yeah.
Maybe you should go back to bed.
I've got to go and sing on stage with this voice.
Good luck with that.
Thank you.
Listeners, we will see you next week when I think we're going to have another really interesting interview about getting out of the echo chamber. I will... leave that mysterious for now. In the meantime, you can find us all over the internet. We are on Twitter at EuropeansPod. We are on Instagram at EuropeansPodcast, if you'd like to see some pictures of Dominic, which I absolutely did not force him to take. And we're on Facebook. Just type in the Europeans Podcast. Have a great week, everyone, and we'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Cheers.